Members, there's a requirement in statute that we submit a price of government resolution to the full Senate by March 15th, I believe, is the day. So we've prepared that for you, for us to consider and send up to the Senate floor. Matt Mossman, our chief fiscal analyst of the Senate, is here to walk us through SCR 011-2. Mr. Mossman?
Mr. Chair and members, just briefly, because I know that you, Matt Mossman, Senate Fiscal Staff, because I know that you've had testimony earlier this session and in previous years on the price of government. The price of government, as I'm sure you know, is a comprehensive measure that was put together in the early 90s, essentially to answer the question or provide information on the question, how much money in total is collected to pay for state and local government services in Minnesota. It's a revenue-based measure that captures nearly all state and local government revenues that are collected both at the local government level by cities, towns, counties, and also school districts. It captures taxes, state taxes, and property taxes. It captures fees and charges, and it captures public college tuition reported by MinSCU and the University of Minnesota. The requirement that you have before you today was enacted into law in 1994 and requires that the governor and the House and the Senate, through a concurring resolution, put forward biennially their recommendations for the price of government. What you have before you, Senate Concurrent Resolution 2, two things that you have before you. One, I would draw your attention, I guess, first to this. There's a one-page handout that identifies the price of government history. What you see there going across the top is the actual price of government through the current fiscal year, which is nearly complete fiscal year 2006-2007. You can see that the price of government, the revenues that are collected are presented in terms of a percentage of personal income to put in context the revenues that are collected state and locally over time. 96, 97, you can see from the chart, just to walk you through, the price of the amount collected was 17.6% of personal income. You can read the numbers going across to fiscal 06, 07. We're at 16.4% of personal income in Minnesota is collected by state and local government to fund state and local services. Then the bottom half, starting in the middle of that page, then provides the actuals for the state and local share, which is also an expectation of the statutory provisions and law that the resolutions and the recommendations identify recommendations for how much of that would be a state share and what portion of it would be a local share. And so that line there in the middle of the actual state and local share shows what the history has been in terms of the amounts collected locally versus the amounts collected by the state. Then in the right hand, two-hand columns of that handout summarizes the recommendations that have been put forth thus far by the governor, the House of Representatives, which acted yesterday on a price of government concurrent resolution, and then back to Senate concurrent resolution number 2 here. Fairly simply stated, on line 1.9 starts the first part of the statutory recommendation, Mr. Chair, that requires that there be a recommendation for the total percentage of state and local revenues as a percent of personal income be stated there, and the resolution identifies 16.4%. Starting on line 112 then reflects the response to the second part of the statutory recommendation, which is to identify a recommendation for a state and local share. And the resolution here puts forth percentages of 63% for state services and 37% local. And then starting on line 1.15 is related to the third reference in statute, which refers to speaking to the mix of taxes that we'll be collecting.
Members, any questions? Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Mossman, you know, we've heard a lot of discussion, the last few sessions, about the investments that the state made in its education and stuff back in the 50s and 60s. And I know this price of government came about in 94, but has anybody looked back over the decades just kind of get a feel for what percentage the Greatest Generation was putting into the infrastructure of the state in comparison to what we're doing today, kind of investing?
Mr. Mossman, how far back can we look and find numbers?
Mr. Chair and Senator Skoy, I'm not aware off the top of my head of a study that has done that. You know, the one issue would be that over the longer you go back, the nature of the arrangement between in-state and local finance may have shifted, and so it would be an interesting question. I'm not aware of any study like that off the top of my head. I'm certain it would be worthwhile, but there would probably be a variety of things to sort out in terms of resulting in an apples-to-apples comparison over that length of time also.
Yeah, thank you.
Anything else, members? You'll see that our resolution continues forward, the same percentage of personal income we expect to spend in the next biennium as in the actual numbers from the previous one. And we do, in the very bottom, suggest in it that the state's share become larger and the local share become smaller. That's a result of the property tax relief that we propose to enact this year. Any other questions, members? Senator Johnson, anything?
Thank you.
Senator Larson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move that document SCR-011-2 be recommended for introduction by the chair on behalf of the committee.
Any other discussion? All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Contrary, no. Motion prevails. Send it to the floor. Senator Betzel. Senate File 892. Senator Betzel, welcome back to the Tax Committee.
Pleasure to be back here again, Mr. Chair. Senate File 892 is a issue that you have some familiarity with. It was actually around last year, and you've seen a different version this year regarding the city of Duluth. And this deals with allowing local governments and school districts to establish a trust to pay for post-employment benefits. As you may be aware, there was a recent report by the legislative auditor finding that there's some liabilities accruing from promises that are being made that are not adequately funded for primarily health care benefits from local government. And we actually had a bill last year that was in both the state local government budget bill in the House and the Senate, but because that bill wound up not being conferred, the issue died with the end of the session last year. Duluth came forward earlier this year because they had more of a crisis situation. They had a more narrowly constructed bill, and they had a couple of features that are not in this particular bill. This is a more of a statewide approach to this, and what this bill does is it allows the local governments and school districts to establish irrevocable or irrevocable trust. Now, the Attorney General's office last year said that there was no authority for them to establish the trust, and that's one of the reasons why we've needed legislation to do that. But this does provide that the a trust can be established. The funds can be deposited either with the Public Employees Retirement Association or a bank or a banking association or an insurance company. And then fees can be charged for the establishment of the trust and the administration of the trust. And as I indicated, one of the big differences between this and what Duluth is seeking is the fact that it can be revocable or irrevocable. If it's If it's revocable, that is, they can terminate the trust at any time if they feel they don't need it. If it's irrevocable, there are limitations on when they can terminate it, and in any case, the monies that are being used in the trust have to be used to pay the benefits that are being established. But as we saw in the Duluth situation, there is a concern down the road that there may be liabilities looming for some of these local governments and school districts if they do not adequately fund these areas, and this is one way for them to do it. I do have some witnesses who are here to testify on the bill and provide any further information. Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, my name is Tom Deans. I am legal counsel of the School Board Association. I've been designated by the other units of government to represent them all here today. This bill has been worked on by all the county groups, all the city groups, all the school districts. They are all in support of it. It is supported by the representatives of the banks and of the insurance companies and agencies. It's been reviewed by the state auditor's office and is incorporated in all the changes that have been requested by the state auditor. It incorporates the changes that were suggested by the legislative auditor in their report, which specifically said that the legislature should amend the statutes to allow local governments to establish trusts for funding other post-employment benefits, which is retiree health insurance. It includes changes to address the issues that were raised by PERA and to make sure that they have no liability if they serve as a trust administrator. The bill also allows, once these trusts are established, the money that's in there can be invested at a higher rate using the same sorts of investments that are used by covered pension funds in the state. And it also grandfathers in a variety of trusts that were established last year primarily by school districts, whose authority the Attorney General took away in its June 6 opinion. And this would grandfather them in. It would allow them to invest at that higher rate and require them to get their trust documents in compliance with this law. Very quickly, the other salient features of this is it allows the trust administrator that could be used to be either PERA or a bank with trust powers or an insurance company or agency which has at least 5 years' experience in investment products and services for group retirement benefits and has a specialized department dedicated to services for retirement benefits. They can be invested, if it's invested through PERA, if you use them as the trust administrator, the State Board of Investment does the investing. If you use the bank or the insurance company, then it's invested by a registered investment advisor, a bank investment trust department, or an insurance company or agency retirement investment department. As I said, it can be invested in the same investments as the covered pension plans. This allows for revocable or irrevocable trusts. If you have a revocable trust, you still must use those funds to pay for post-employment benefits, but then there's four exceptions that are laid out. For instance, if you had 10 people that were retirees that qualified and five of them died 1 year, you may have too much money in there and it would allow you to take that excess out. That's one of the examples. For an irrevocable account, you have to leave that money in there until all those liabilities have gone away. The provisions in Subdivision 8 basically establish that none of the party's creditors can get to this money. It can't be attached by the creditors of the state, the creditors of the political subdivision, the creditors of the employees, or the creditors of the trust administrator, and that's recommended by the legislative auditor. And then Section 2 is the validation of those prior trusts. That's a sort of a capsule.
Thank you, Mr. Means. Members, we saw something similar to this for the city of Duluth. I thought that it might be helpful for it to come through the tax committee so the tax committee could see that we were going to allow all of our political subdivisions to set up separate accounts to address this liability that they have for post-employment benefits. Any questions?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Johnson.
I'm looking at the fiscal note, Mr. Chair, and it says no implications. Or is this the fiscal note?
Is there one? Is there
I haven't seen
one? I don't believe there is a fiscal note. There shouldn't be.
There is
not from revenue.
It's a revenue note, Mr. Chair, that we have, but
Mr. Chair, how is this going to be paid for?
Senator Johnson, there's nothing to pay for. I mean, the political subdivision is just authorized to set up a trust account to deposit their own money in, so they can hopefully make a greater rate of return than they can under current law. Is that accurate, Senator Bethel?
Well, ultimately, you know, tax dollars are going to have to pay for the benefits one way or the other. We just want the divisions to be set aside the money now rather than being in a situation like Duluth was when all of a sudden the bill comes due and they haven't got the money set aside to pay for it. But it will be tax dollars from the local jurisdictions that fund this. These are not state dollars. They are allowed to charge, obviously, for the the trusts are allowed to charge fees for maintaining these services, but that's ultimately how it's all going to be paid for.
Senator Ortman.
Mr. Chair, it was my understanding, Senator Johnson, that there was an administrative fee for each of the trusts and the development of the trust, so the funds themselves are financing the administration. Is that correct, sir?
Mr. Chair and Senator Ortman, if you'll look at on page 2, starting line 2.6, and if you specifically look at 2.9, the trust administrator may charge participating political subdivisions and political entity fees for reasonable administrative costs. The amount of fees charged by PERA is appropriated to the association from the account. So this sets up the fact we don't specify how much, but fees may be charged. And this will also cause the bill to go to the Finance Committee.
Senator Pogemiller.
Chairman, Senator Bedsold, I on lines 1.23, 2.4, 1.23, 1.24, 2.1, 2.2, why is it necessary to allow this, frankly, the bank, too? Why are you allowing options 2 and 3?
Mr. Chair, Senator Pogemiller, it's good. That's a very good question. Last year when we were working on it, it only allowed the money to be deposited in the State Board of Investment through PERA. The banks and the insurance companies did come forward, and they wanted the opportunity to bid on the money to provide what they felt were better rates of return. I think that we have to recognize that there could be some risk in doing so, because I don't think the State Board of Investment is going to go out of business, but it could very well be that something could go wrong in investment with the bank and insurance companies. That having been said, the state auditor has reviewed this now. The I don't know if the Attorney General has reviewed this particular part. Maybe Mr. Deans knows that, but those issues seem to have been resolved by, to the satisfaction of the state auditor, that this can be done. But I think there is a recognized risk there beyond the State Board of Investment type of investments.
Mr.
Beans.
There was a great deal of discussion that took place in the working group when we were putting this together, and people probably are here that could testify. But for instance, U.S. Bank does this for the entire, or lots of political subdivisions, or perhaps the entire state of California. I mean, they're experienced in doing this type of investing. And also, the bill does provide that if you pick one and it turns out that they're not doing the job that you thought, and they're not getting the investment returns that you thought, that you're allowed to change. And if you also look at the language that's on page 2.14 to 2.18, that's language that was requested by the state auditor. And there, to the extent that fees are charged and the annual rate of return, that has to be set out in your audit report in a way that the state auditor requires so that it's comparable, you can compare it between political subdivisions, and that those fees are transparent.
Mr. Chairman? But if we have a local unit that got themselves into this situation, why are we so certain now that they will pick a most economically efficient vendor? Well, I'm a little concerned about this, Mr. Chairman. Yeah. This is more than the Duluth bill.
Oh, yeah.
That's correct, Senator Bogomar.
And I think the lines 1.20 to 2.2 make me, I don't think I'm convinced.
And Mr. Chair,
I understand that the industry would like that.
Oh, yeah.
It's like they would like all kinds of things. Okay. But that doesn't mean it's a good idea.
Certainly, Mr. Chair, I can assure you, a year ago when I was carrying the bill, the then state auditor felt very strongly that it should only be invested with the PERA and the State Board of Investment, and that the banks and the insurance company should not be included. And that did create a bit of a, well, firestorm of controversy that ultimately, as I say, the bill did not pass last year. I don't think it's fair to say, though, that organizations that have gotten themselves into trouble, because I think Duluth is a situation where they have that situation right now. There are many local units of government that, frankly, are not in the crisis situation. They are trying to plan ahead. So I don't know that it's – I'd categorize them as saying that they have any trouble right now. They just want to make sure that they don't get into trouble. So I think it's a bit of a different situation. But this does create, as I indicated earlier, a broader scope – that was in the Duluth bill, because that was very narrowly crafted to deal with their own situation. This is a bit broader. And I'm sure there are people representing the banks and the insurance companies that would be more than happy to testify as to why they want to be included in this, and I don't know if they're here or not, but they certainly let their voices be known on this one. So,
Mr. Johnson, you have anything to add? Senator Orban.
Mr. Chair, I was going to ask if maybe some clarification about which funds are revocable and which ones are irrevocable might help here. Last year I was concerned about this bill because there was no opportunity for competition, because all of the funds were going to be sent to the State Investment Board, and I'm not sure that the State Investment Board was prepared to manage all of these funds from all these different political subdivisions. So I'm hoping some clarification of the revocable versus irrevocable might help and shed some light on this discussion.
Mr. Beans?
Mr. Chair, the political subdivision can decide whether or not they want to make the fund revocable or whether they want to make it irrevocable. If it's revocable, that does not allow you to offset that money against your liabilities when you do your balance sheet. That's one of the things that GASB 45 says, is you can if you put the money in an irrevocable account, it offsets that liability. However, there are a number of political subdivisions in the state that have their only OPEB shows up because of what's called the implicit subsidy. And the reason that comes up is retirees, from the time they retire until they qualify for Medicare, in Minnesota have to be carried in the same pool as active employees. And they're charged, you know, the same amount, although their individual share may be the same. But when you determine what their premium cost is, it's the same as the active employees. The accounting standard says that we're subsidizing those retirees because we're not charging them the higher rate because they're older. And we, under this accounting standard, you have to count that as a liability, the fact that you're subsidizing that, even though it's, you know, just going forward and doing it the same way that we've always been doing it. And we're not allowed to do it a different way because state law requires that they be in the same pool. So many, many places have said, you know, they think that that's contingent enough that they don't want to lock that money up for 20 years. They want to put it in a revocable account, and then if the law changes, you get universal care coming from the feds. The feds lower the age of Medicare to 55, or, you know, all these kinds of fixes that you hear people talking about. Then, you know, in theory, they wouldn't have this OPEB liability again, and they could take that money out. Especially some of the big counties are very, very concerned about that.
Thank you.
Mr. Johnson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. My name is Steve Johnson, Director of Government Relations at the Minnesota Bankers Association. And just briefly to Senator Bogenmiller's points, indeed, the banks would like to be able to offer this product to local units of government. And as Mr. Deans and Senator Betzel mentioned, it is optional, or it's a choice. It's not a mandate that the banks get it. We would just like to have the opportunity to bid for the funds, bid for the process, along with the other entities. And again, the local government has the ultimate choice. If they think our product or insurance products or the State Board investment product is a better product for them. And you know, banks are highly regulated, regularly examined, so and provide a good opportunity for folks to invest their funds there. But again, it's optional or a choice. They can pick who they would like to pick. So,
Mr. Johnson, do you have any idea how many banks have trust divisions in Minnesota?
Mr. Chairman, I believe it's under 50. It's somewhere in the 30 to 50 range.
Senator Pogamore, what do you think about that?
Well, the more I read the bill, I mean, what doesn't the bill allow? It allows basically everything. It allows revocable, irrevocable. You can revoke it with four conditions here, all of which are probably going to take place. And you can basically use any vendor that wants to try to sell you a product. So this is a lot different than the Duluth bill. Might be a good idea, but I wouldn't compare it to the Duluth bill.
Ms. Chairman, if I could just...
Mr. Beans.
If I can respond just in a perhaps looking at this a different way. The OPEB liability that these units have, in most cases, maybe not in Duluth, but in most cases, is a pretty small number compared to the amount of money that flows through that political subdivision. We allow those political subdivisions to invest all of that money today. This is a little slice of it. We trust those local people to do those investments. We don't require them to go through a bank with trust powers. We don't require them to do any of that. Their business manager, their finance director can do those investments. And that's a lot of money, a lot more money than this. And this is a small piece, but we tried to build a number of protections in here. They can only be invested the same way that your covered pensions plans are now. You've got to have these people with these specialized investing experience that can serve as the trust administrator. That's all I can say.
Oh, but Mr. Chairman?
Senator Pogamore.
Is there any doubt that these local units of government are going to be asking the state to help pay for this at some point?
Ms. Chairman, that may or may not happen, but that doesn't happen in this bill. The OPEB is already there.
This is a procedural
accounting bill.
Do you think it may happen that they're going to come and ask us to help?
It could happen as soon as the next bill, but but this is a procedural accounting thing right now because of the AG opinion. We're not allowed to comply with GASB 45.
That's the point.
The AG, we believe wrongly, said that political subdivisions do not have the authority to set up one of these trusts, and this allows them to comply with GASB 45. And if it's an irrevocable trust and they've put that money aside, whether or not it qualifies for GASB 45, it allows Moody's to look and see they're doing something here to address this issue so that they don't get downgraded.
Senator Scoy.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Deans, I get the reason to put it into the irrevocable trust, but I don't understand the rationale of why a local government would put it into the revocable trust, because they don't get to count it against their liabilities. And so, and they can take it out with these four conditions that Senator Pogemiller has pointed out. So what's the rationale for having that vehicle available?
Let me let the county representative speak.
Mr. Chairman, members, I'm Keith Carlson, Executive Director of the Metropolitan Association. Mr. Deans has already covered, to some extent, the reason why OPEB liability exists whatsoever for the majority of cities, for the majority of counties, at least for new hires, and for a substantial amount of school districts. The only reason we have any liability to report be reported under the new accounting standard, GASB 45, is the requirement of state law that we must allow retirees to participate in our group health benefits or insurance programs, and due to what they call the implicit subsidy between, in effect, the younger generation and the older generation that thus participate in those plans. Anything that can come along that would potentially change that liability, including a change in the demographics of the employee group that's covered, a change in state or federal law that would modify that liability, or some other factor that we don't anticipate, creates a great deal of consternation and indecisiveness on the part of local government fiscal managers on how to deal with this. GASB 45 does not require you to set aside money, period. It doesn't require you to create trust. It doesn't require you to invest the money in a certain way. It merely requires you to recognize this liability on your accounting statements. As Mr. Dean said, to claim assets against that liability, the money has to be set aside in an irrevocable trust. But as far as the broader financial community is concerned, if you're taking care of it by taking some proactive action, such as setting the money aside in a revocable trust or something else that will demonstrate to them that you're serious about addressing this liability, that's fine for the broader financial community and should not adversely affect your bond rating. The bottom line is the bill in lines 39 through 326 does allow the withdrawal of money from these revocable trusts. But if you look down on lines 323 through 326, only to the extent that the amount is in excess of 100% of the political subdivision's actuarially determined liability. So whatever is in there, they have to leave behind what they believe, according to their actuaries' calculations, is the current liability for these. The only thing that they can take out from these revocable trusts is money in excess of that liability, and this just deals with those various contingencies that I just went through so they can get at that money if at some times in the future things change and they no longer have to have this money locked up.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson.
Ms. Almeida, do you have something to add?
Mr. Chairman and members, I'm Christine Almeida representing National Insurance Services, which is one of the private sector entities that wishes, like banks and insurance companies, to be able to participate in this particular market. in trying to get a little bit at some of Senator Pogemiller's concerns, I think a little historical context might be helpful for the committee. And there are some of you who I know worked on this issue last year and are familiar with what happened. Last year, the state auditor brought to the legislature, as someone earlier mentioned, a bill that would have restricted OPEB investments to be made in PERA. And that bill was did not pass. And over the course of last interim, a number of the groups that are interested in this particular issue got together and have done a tremendous amount of work to put together this particular bill, and looked at the Attorney General's opinion, talked with the current state auditor about her feeling on the topic, and the local governments clearly are interested in having options, and there are members on both sides of the aisle in the Senate who have local governmental entities who right now use private investments with good result. And so I hope that helps to add a little bit of context to some of the concerns that Senator Pogemiller had and to help you understand what transpired last year and what took place between now and then and now to get us to this particular spot. I have with me Aaron Casper from National Insurance Services, who just has a couple of comments, again, to Senator Pogemiller's concerns.
Thank you. Aaron Casper with National Insurance Services. Mr. Chair, Senator Pogemiller, I've been working on this issue specifically with school districts for over 4 years. And as Christine mentioned, the historical context of where we're at today, last year we would have been excluded from providing those services that we've been working on as an organization for a period of 4 years. So really what we're looking for in the bill is just local choice. There's obviously we cannot predict the future, but we feel that if we can have some competition to the State Board of Investment, and then let the locals choose on who they would like to work with, given their past performance, their total offering relative to trust administration, the trust document itself, the fees associated with it, and obviously ultimately the rate of return. We think that would be a good thing for the private sector or the public sector. And just one more comment: when I've been out there working with these local entities. It's very obvious that they would be comfortable with working with private sector firms because they do that today. There are literally hundreds of millions of dollars that are being handled by private sector firms. Although I will say that it is under the constraints of current Minnesota Statute 118A, which restricts the what that money can be used for. So really the only difference would be is that the funds could be used in a variable type investment. And obviously, given what was mentioned earlier, this is purely a choice. Nothing in GASB 45 or even in this proposed legislation states that an individual entity, whether it be a city, county, or school district, has to put money into this trust. But if they would like to meet the funding requirements for Statement 45, they have the ability to do that. Currently, there are a multitude of states out there today that also allow for private sector investment advice through a registered investment advisor. Wisconsin, our neighbor to the east, for example, has a prudent man in investment strategy, and I just wanted to leave you with that. Thank you, Senator Pogemiller, Mr. Chair.
Senator Bethold, anything further? Well,
I don't have anything further.
Senator Betzold, I think maybe Mr. Johnson can answer this, but on lines 2.34 to 2.36, where we allow the trust administrator may only be invested in investments authorized under 118A or sections 353A.06. What are those type of investments? I think the chair might be more comfortable, Senator Betzold, if we lay this over for a little bit.
That's fine.
And I think it might help. Members might want to take a look at the kind of investments that we would then allow municipalities to invest in. Members, take a
look. We can make copies of these and hand them out.
Senator
Pullman.
State Board of Investment has 306.
I don't believe they are.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Carlson.
Members, I'll address Senator Pogemiller's question first. Yes, essentially the investments that are identified in 356A identify the type of assets that the State Board of Investment invest in primarily on behalf of the pension funds. Okay. The whole point of citing 356A as an allowable investment is to allow the local governments access to these types of long-term, higher-yielding investments as is appropriate for the long-term nature of the money that they're setting aside. If they elect to put money in these trusts, they are investing for a benefit that's going to be paid 20 or even 30 years from now, and thus it's appropriate to give them the same sort of authority that they have right now to invest their monies for pensions when it's locally administered, such as a volunteer fire fund or to the extent there are any local police and fire funds. For example, this would cover the Minneapolis Fire System, MRF, the Minneapolis Police Fund. This is exactly the investment authority that they have right now. If you take this away from us in this bill, then basically the monies we're setting aside is only going to earn a rate of return consistent with what we can get under current authority within Chapter 118A, which is basically monies that we would deposit in a bank account. And so we're not, absent that authority, we're not investing that money as efficaciously as we could on behalf of our taxpayers, and consequently what they will be paying over the long term will be substantially greater. We need this authority to invest this money as efficiently at as high a yield as we can possibly get.
Well, Mr. Carlson, I understand that, and municipalities certainly could do that through this if this bill were to pass and they're given the opportunity to invest through the State Board of Investment. We could accomplish that. I think, to Senator Pogemiller's point, I can see down the road some member coming with a bill because their municipality maybe had an investment manager outside of the State Board that performed very poorly, and I can see maybe a flurry of bills where that may happen in the financial markets and the state being asked to keep those municipalities whole. You know, it's one thing for us, I think, to be asked to deal with the Minnesota State Board of Investment. It's a whole nother deal when we start putting ourselves into those relationships between our municipalities and private banks. So I think, members, might be a good idea for us to think about this a little bit, the idea that this is a big change. Senator Ortman?
Mr. Chair and members, I think that this is a good bill. It's come a long way over the last couple of years. We've got political municipalities, school districts, counties that are trying to be responsible with the funds that they have and to protect the employees long term. And the state government is now getting in their way. They're trying to do the right thing to protect the investments, and now we have statutes that conflict, and attorney general's opinions that conflict with the best accounting practices and investment practices for these agencies. We passed the Duluth bill because we recognized that there was an immediate need to get those funds invested properly, and I think there's an immediate need statewide right now. Scott County came to me and said they need this authority. The fact that we've got alternative investment products through the private sector does not concern me. In fact, I think it's a good thing. I think that the competition is really good. We have some of these local communities that are currently investing that way, and there are protections in this bill. I was satisfied when I saw in section or subdivision 7 that even if it's a revocable trust, meaning they can take funds out, but they have to fund the liabilities first. That means only those dollars that are perhaps interest dollars that are over and above all the responsibility to all the employees and to the local subdivision, only then can some of those funds be taken out. That means if they've succeeded in safely investing these funds and are getting a good return. Mr. Chair.
That's what Subdivision 7 says, what you just said.
Mr. Chair and Senator Pogemiller, we had some clarification on that. We can have it again. But I think that we should not be getting in the way of these communities that want to invest these funds properly. And the risk that they all face of not being able to long-term manage their pensions should not be the factor that stops us from passing this bill, because there are many across the state that have those concerns. Nothing is stopping them, as the testifier said, from coming back later and saying they don't have enough funds. We're all at risk of that. But why wouldn't we let those communities that are ready to invest and are ready to take responsibility for these funds do so in the way that they see, you know, best see fit, and the way that government agency and accounting standards would support? I think that we should allow them to do what best practices suggest that they do, which is invest these funds in revocable and irrevocable trusts.
Senator Ortman, I'm not suggesting that this is not a good idea. I am just suggesting that maybe before we make this big a change, we might want to think about it until Thursday. I think we tend to do better work when we take a little longer around here. Mm-hmm. Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And all this conversation to me, all this need, this overstatement of needs by the county, sounds like these investments are already failing.
Mr. Carlson, would you like to address that?
Mr. Chairman, the only investment authority available to any local government, I believe, is under Chapter 118A, other than our investments for pensions, which is basically consistent with the language that you see at the bottom of page 2. So we're pretty much constrained to putting our monies in deposit accounts or other accounts with banks right now, and can only earn a rate of return consistent with those types of accounts.
But, Mr. Chair.
Senator Johnson.
Maybe analytically, looking at those retirements and what's coming up in the future, you can see that your trajectory isn't going to meet the need. And that's why there's all this demand to create a higher yield.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, I think you're addressing the issue as to whether or not we're managing our cost relating to retiree health care. And I can tell you on behalf of counties, or at least the counties that are members of our organization, the handful that had the benefits above and but beyond what was required by state law have universally basically cut off the benefit for new hires. We do not have retiree health care other than a modest guarantee that based on your years of employment, we will set aside X amount of dollars in a retiree health care savings plan that was essentially created by the legislature several years ago. We have no huge liability or obligation to our current hires.
Senator Betzel, I'm told that our schedule's pretty full for Thursday. We think we'd have time to come back next Tuesday and give the committee some time to think about this. Members, let's just think about, and I'm not at all indicating that this isn't a good idea, but I think this is a pretty big change, and maybe we should take a little more time to think about what potential ramifications might be down the road on this. Senator Betzel, is next Tuesday?
I'm around.
Mr. Beans? Carlson? Mr. Johnson, going to be around next Tuesday? Ms. Almeida? Senator Skoy moves that Senate file 892 be laid on the table, and members will schedule it for next Tuesday. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Betzel.
See you out there.
It would help, members, if those of you that, as you think about this, please spend some time thinking about it so that next Tuesday when we take it back, we can figure out if we need to make any changes before we move it forward to finance. Mr. Carlson? Senate File 1169, one of the chair's bills, similar subject, different approach. Mr. Carlson, tell us what we're doing with Senate File 1169.
Mr. Chairman, members, as we've discussed, a new accounting standard, GASB 45, which goes into effect this year for counties and cities with over $100 million and will go into effect in the next 2 years for the smaller local governments, requires us to account for retiree health care and other post-employment benefits on a pay as the benefit is accrued or earned rather than the past practice of as the benefit is actually paid out. As a consequence, the affected local governments, especially those with benefits that go beyond the requirements of state laws, will have large liabilities showing up on their financial statements. And the responsible thing to do is to demonstrate to both current bondholders and potential future bondholders, and particularly the rating agencies, that the entity is doing something to buy that liability down. What this bill does is provide one way to sort of ease into buying that liability down by giving the local government the authority to issue bonds to capitalize the monies that are set aside to pay these benefits. The import of this is for, again, those with potentially large liabilities due to the new accounting standard. If they were just to pay for it out of current property tax revenues, that they would have potentially a large spike next year when the new accounting standard shows up in their financial statements for the current year. They'll be due by the summer of 2008. This will, in effect, allow them to spread paying off those liabilities over the terms of the bond. This is the same authority that's granted currently for pension liabilities. The city of Minneapolis has used this on a couple occasions for both, I'm not sure if it was its police fund or its fire fund, and MRF when they had basically the same phenomena when there was a large spike in their funding obligations, and instead of paying it off with current property taxes, they issued bonds and, in effect, amortized it over the term of the bonds. Mr. Chairman, that's a short explanation.
Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Carlson, is the same apply to new hires now, that they're not being offered the same as you testified on the last bill?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, I can only respond to for, again, the members of my association, and I guess I can respond for Ramsey County. Anoka County, Washington County, I believe Scott County, and Ramsey County all had retiree health care that went beyond the provisions of state law, and thus were more dangerous than that you, in effect, create the obligation for us. All of those counties have basically cut off new hires. The only thing, again, that is being offered to those individuals is a small amount of salary is being set aside in health care savings plans on their behalf based on their years of service. So it's not an unlimited obligation that will depend on what the future cost of health care is.
Senator Johnson.
Mr. Chair. Mr. Carlson, what I want to say about this bill in comparison to the last bill is there's a lot of transparency here, honesty and clarity, and I appreciate that. I don't know which is a better way to go, but this way at least seems very transparent and not as high risk. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, if I could just respond. This bill is a completely separate, it's a related issue. This just creates a way to pay for the cost. The other bill is whether or not you can create the trust and advantage yourself as greatly as possible in conforming with the new accounting standard and investing the monies at a higher yield. This is one way of coming up with the money. They're related but distinct things.
Any other questions, members? Without objection, the chair lays over Senate File 1169 for possible inclusion in the committee bill. Thank you, Mr. Carlson. Senator Scogin here. Fergus Falls Regional Treatment Center Campus, tax-free Renaissance Zone. I would bet, Senator Scogin, you probably have somebody here to testify also.
I do. We'll get them all up here. We might not need them all, but we'll give them an opportunity to sit at the table.
Mr. Chair, committee, turn your attention to Senate File 1634. The packet you're getting, if you'll open them, the photo in there is a building that the state of Minnesota currently owns. And Senate File 1634 brings the state of Minnesota and the city and the region around Fergus Falls to a crossroads. And I consider Senate File 1634 a bill of opportunity. What you're looking at is what, when I was growing up, we called the State Hospital. It was then renamed the Regional Treatment Center. You're looking at a facility that is built in the Kirkbride style, over 740,000 square feet, on over 100 acres, over 100 years old, and has served the Fergus Falls region very well. Its usefulness as a regional treatment center has come to an end. What this bill would do would put that facility, a facility of over 740,000 square feet, back on the tax rolls. The city of Fergus Falls and the area needs the right tools to attract developers to this kind of a project. Mr. Chair and committee, I believe that the tool is the creation of a Renaissance Zone on the campus in Fergus Falls. Some would call it incentives. I think of it as opportunities. Opportunities for economic development in rural Minnesota. Opportunities for the state to take a $10 million liability and put it back on the tax rolls. An opportunity for the state to relieve itself of this burden while creating an opportunity for the Fergus Falls region. I would also like to thank Senator Scoy and Langseth for taking the time to come to Fergus Falls and meet with us up there and take a look at that facility as well. And with that, helping me present Senate File 1634 today are officials from Fergus Falls, and I'll turn the presentation over to Executive Director of Economic Development in Fergus Falls, Harold Stanislawski.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Harold Stanislawski, Executive Director of the Economic Improvement Commission in Fergus Falls. We're delighted to be here today to visit with you about the Fergus Falls RTC. The RTC, really is a building marvel that sits on 116 acres on the northern end of the community of Fergus Falls. It does have about 744,000 square feet and 24 buildings, and is currently being phased out of all state activities that are currently operated in the facility. The State of Minnesota Department of Human Services has operated several programs out of the RTC in recent years. The most recent programs to exit the RTC have been the mental illness program, and soon, in 2007, the chemical dependency unit will move to a new facility that the county and the city are working on for them. The state has initiated a process for a reuse with the city of Fergus Falls. A failure to find a reuse may result in demolishment of this last remaining intact Kirkbride facility. The estimated cost for demolishment and abatement, according to Maxwell Research and the BKV group that was initiated by the state of Minnesota, was estimated to cost $9.8 million back in 2004. 2007 dollars, who knows what it might cost. Five of the outlying buildings have letters of intent with developers, providing we can get to successful close on that. In your packet, we have resolutions of support from the City Council in Fergus Falls and Otter Tail County Commissioners supporting a Renaissance Zone. A Renaissance Zone would be a very powerful market-based incentive tool for us to spur economic growth in a mixed-use type of environment in this facility. Again, if you look at that picture and you look at the magnitude of that facility, there is no one particular use, perhaps, that is going to occupy that much space. So we have to look at a mixed use. A Renaissance Zone would be the tool we would use based on the successful use of this tool in Michigan. The Traverse City Kirkbride building used the Renaissance program, and they are well on their way to being successful. I'll answer a few questions about the Renaissance Zone particulars, but before we do that, I'd like to introduce the Honorable Mayor Russ Anderson of Fergus Falls.
Mayor Anderson.
Yes, for the record, my name is Russ Anderson. I'm the Mayor of Fergus Falls, and Mr. Chair, I and committee members, I'd like to thank you very much for your time consideration today. The City of Fergus Falls has worked tirelessly helping the state address and solve their problems. We have been the long-term energy suppliers for the campus, and we have helped tenants from this campus relocate. Some of them were state agencies, and we constructed at city expense and now leased to the state of Minnesota a new community health-based hospital. We are working with Otter Tail County to construct a new chemical dependency hospital, and in relation to that, we have extended some $100,000 to get infrastructure to that site, and that would also be at no cost to the state of Minnesota. The Fergus Falls Regional Treatment Center is a state-owned facility. The city has stepped up to the plate to help redevelop this area. The redevelopment of a facility of this magnitude in excess of 800,000 square feet and in a community the size of Fergus located in greater Minnesota requires more tools than are currently available in the area. This request is for the treatment center only. We believe that this is a very unique circumstance. It is a state facility and has that historic and economic importance. Job creation, business development, historic preservation and renewal are the primary goals of redevelopment of this campus. And the resulting effects of such a zone would be to provide mixed-use tax base, to spur job creation, business, and also housing development. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to turn it over now to Rick Anderson, who is a Fergus Falls business person, who will discuss some of the particulars about the Renaissance Zone itself.
Renaissance Zone is patterned after
Mr. Anderson, please state your name and who you might represent.
Sure, Mr. Chairman. My name is Richard Anderson from Fergus Falls. The Renaissance Zone is patterned after the Renaissance Zone in Michigan. What it does is it provides a tax-free zone on the Fergus Falls RTC campus. It would exempt them from Minnesota corporate franchise tax, individual income tax, and local property taxes for a period of 15 years, and it's phased in the last 3 years of the program. A project of this size, the reason that we're asking for 15 years is that a community the size of Fergus Falls with 15,000 population, we can only absorb X amount of square footage of office space and commercial space in any given year. On a mixed-use project such as this, residential, we only have about 50 housing permits per year, and so to utilize 700,000 square feet, whether it be commercially or residential, it would take quite a few years to utilize that space.
In addition, this Renaissance Zone creates really a very powerful marketing tool for us to, you know, to move this state-owned property back into the private sector. Again, I want to emphasize that mixed-use development is the goal here. We've studied this in Michigan. That's what was successful there. And with this mixed-use type of environment with housing, retail, office, and the like, we have the best success of turning what now appears to be a liability back into a viable asset for our community and for the state of Minnesota. But it will take time. This campus is so much different than many of the other state-owned campuses around the state. As you can see, it's all one building tied together, which makes it unique from other campuses in the state. So with that in mind, we really feel that this will be an economic development tool in the toolbox that should spur the right kind of development to get at least a portion, if not all, of this redeveloped over time. And that would be a win-win for everyone.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is this an all wood frame building outside of the edifice right in front of it?
The building is mostly made of concrete on steel. So it's a steel superstructure with concrete. There's a portion of the building that was built first that's concrete on wood. But the facility is in amazingly good shape. This facility was built for 600 years. Lifespan. It's gone through about 111 so far, so it's really an infant out there. But as times change and so forth, you know, it's not the kind of facility that the mental health and all the rest of it can use today.
One question I had, Ms. Chair, is there competition for business space in the city of Fergus? You know, you hear so often when the local big box store develops on the outskirts of a town, the Main Street businesses get all upset. Is there a competition like that in your town? If this was developed into something else, is there concern about that?
You know, that's not peculiar just to the city of Fergus Falls, but it the issue here is, I think, that the opportunity in this one is for expanded businesses to come in, the spaces that are there can be adjusted and allowed to fit any variety of business. Some of the rooms are very large now. I spent my entire past life we were floor covering contractors and in the construction business, and that place up there is as solid as a fort. It's a beautiful structure, and I just feel that this Renaissance Zone would give not only take a burden from the state of Minnesota, but it would also provide something very viable to the growth of Fergus Falls.
Mr. Chair and Mayor, is your population growing up there?
Yes, it is. We are right at about 14,000, and within the peripheral areas around there, there are over 30,000 people, and that's not extending very far out of town. There's several bedroom communities right on the edge of town, and they keep growing. So.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Limmer, if you live here, if you decide to locate here, you would have a $10,000 credit towards your income tax liability. I was just wondering, maybe Senator Scogin can get together with Senator Vickerman. There's a bill to exempt military pensions from income tax liability. Maybe we could move a bunch of those military pensioners like former Senator Dean Johnson into this facility. They can get their income tax waived like they've requested in an earlier bill in front of this committee. We might get some synergy going.
Mr. Chair, let's not muddy the waters.
Yeah. Just trying to be helpful. Sometimes we can create a partnership here that moves the ball forward.
But I do think that Senator Johnson would be welcome. We have 34 churches in Fergus. So.
Senator Scoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and maybe Mr. Stanislawski or Mayor Anderson. If the legislature does pass this and this idea would become law, what organization would take over the responsibility of this? And, you know, currently I think you did mention the state's cost to tearing it down and that cost that we would be not having to bear anymore, but who would be picking up the responsibility and what organization would be doing that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Scoy, experience tells me that I think we would like to perhaps work with the Department of Employment and Economic Development on the rules and procedures and so forth as we move forward on this zone. We're already familiar working with them on other programs, so it makes sense for us to, you know, to maybe get some guidance from that particular agency as we move forward. And also, we know that anytime we have a tax incentive program, that the Minnesota Department of Revenue is very much involved, and we've got a very good working relationship with them on other programs as well. So those would be the two, I think, that would work with maybe the economic authority in Fergus Falls being the subzone administrator, if you will, of this particular zone, which, again, is only limited to the state-owned campus. No other acres apply here, and I want to make that very clear.
Mr. Senator Chair, did I hear you say that the city would be coming the responsible party, or who would you expect would be doing that?
Well, I believe, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I believe that we could develop a partnership with DEED on this. We're obviously on site, so we could handle some of the details, if you will, but some of the guidance, the policy, the procedures, it's prudent to have some of that perhaps at DEED, that is in economic development and understands what we're doing.
I'm not getting the point that I'm making to you. Currently, the state is responsible for this building, and it's a proposal to spend almost or more than $10 million. We would like to not expend that money and would like to not tear this building down. Such a unique building. If this becomes a Renaissance zone, how is the state going to be relieved of its responsibilities of ownership of this building?
Okay, I understand what you're saying now. Mr. Chair, Senator Scoy, there's a couple of ideas that could possibly work in that regard. First of all, you know, we need time to see how this Renaissance zone starts to work. Indeed, no one knows if we're going to be able to completely redevelop the entire campus, but we may be able to redevelop 70%, 50%, or whatever. The remaining portion, then, there would probably have to be some policy in place where that indeed may be demolished in time. But we don't know that yet. So I think we'd have to have a partnership with the state a little bit here to see how this goes, and certainly the city could play a role, but those kinds of details would have to be worked out over time. because indeed we might have to demolish a portion of this campus.
Senator Limmer.
One last question. Do the tax benefits that would follow to the businesses, is that just a resident of your city, or would it apply to any business that would locate there?
It would be any business that would locate there. And preferably it would be businesses from North Dakota.
We put that in the bill, Mr. Anderson?
Pardon me? Sure.
We put that in the bill that we're seeking businesses from the Dakotas or Wisconsin?
Mr. Chair, what?
I mean, the governor of Wisconsin's trying to steal business from us, we've heard in this committee.
When we drove down yesterday, we hear lots of radio ads from Sioux Falls, South Dakota, saying, you know, no income tax, no corporate income tax. What this really does is it puts Fergus Falls on a level playing field with those other states.
Mr. Anderson, don't they have a sales tax on food in South Dakota?
They do.
The average grocery bill in any community would only be about $100 a week, so that's a minimum impact.
Senator Limmer.
Mr. Chair, why North Dakota? Why would you mention North Dakotans wanting to put a business?
We're 40 minutes from North Dakota. We have a significant retail leakage to Fargo, North Dakota. I'm a publisher in Fergus Falls. We do surveys of our market. We know that one-third of our area residents shop in North Dakota. Price selection. You asked the question earlier about existing businesses and how this would impact them. We currently have a 40% occupancy in our mall, and we're working on the redevelopment of that mall. Any new businesses that we would receive in Fergus Falls would be welcome because it would provide more variety and it would keep our residents in town and spending their money in town.
Mr. Chair, your mall, there's a mall in Fergus Falls.
That is
with
correct.
40% occupancy, does that mean 60% vacancy rate?
That is correct.
And now we want to take this building with all of its square footage and try and find tenants for it?
I certainly understand where you're going. This RTC location is on the north end of the community, and it's certainly not in a retail situation. The traffic patterns, I mean, a retailer coming to Fergus Falls would not locate in this area because of traffic patterns, traffic counts and stuff like that. You can't. We have a vacancy in our prime retail area, so that's where they would go first because that's where they will succeed.
Senator Langseth.
Mr. Chair, you know, the state demographer has made predictions about growth in rural Minnesota in the Lakes Country. You take from the Twin Cities all the way up, probably decline in the non-Lakes area. Well, Fergus Falls is located right on the western edge of a very, I mean, many, many lakes within Otter Tail County, and Otter Tail County is expected to grow by Fairmont because of that. I remember a few years ago, and if I remember this correctly, there was a business that located from Jamestown, North Dakota to Fergus Falls, and he was asked, why did you do that? And he said, I won't miss the lakes at Jamestown. There's no lakes at Jamestown. So I think just located in Lakes Country, I mean, even businesses are locating in areas where they want to live. And this Fergus Falls area, and it's right on 94, which makes it very economical, but it's also in Lakes Country. And according to the demographer, that's where the growth is going to be in rural Minnesota.
Senator Ortman, someone suggested to me that this might be a good location for Thompson West expansion. A couple thousand jobs. You think any attorneys would move to Fergus Falls and live on some of the lakes up there?
Absolutely.
I think that's. Yeah, we have 1,100 lakes in Otter Tail County of over 5 acres. So that's.
Senator Ortman? The concern was they're going to have primary residences up there or just seasonal cabins. They might want to come and testify about the tax rates.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Moore.
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Larson and I were thinking about phase two of the Mall America, but that's up to Senator Larson to decide. Senator Scogin, it's gorgeous. It's beautiful. And I'm wondering if the project is a little bit too preliminary in that I don't have a good sense that there has been tenants or sort of a broader vision defined for the campus yet. And is that just because we haven't given you a chance to testify on that, or has there been some thought into my heart just sinks to think that this is going to be a minute project by project, and that, you know, a portion of it might get demolished. And I'm wondering if there's been any effort to look at a broader, larger vision of keeping the campus intact, doing some kind of entertainment complex. I am looking forward to enjoying, like, a grand resort in Lake Country, and I would love to come and see this this location.
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator, we have been brainstorming, but because of, without the Renaissance Zone, our hands are tied a little bit on the developers that we can attract and the scope of some of the projects. Now, we believe that with Renaissance Zone financing, developers will come to us that have bigger projects that are probably thinking outside the box. So when we talk about multi-use, we talk everything from condominiums, which they did in Michigan. We've talked, I think, seriously about a school setting for languages, maybe for a world school where we would actually house students. We have talked about, help me, Harold, with some of the other outside the...
Well, we've talked about bioscience type of industries. We've had discussions with those. There are some that would consider locating in Fergus Falls. And, you know, that's promising. We're also in an RFP process right now. We have a developer on the table that has looked at this, but as we've looked at his plans and what's required in order to have it, to make it happen, that particular developer is familiar with Renaissance Zone in Michigan and in Fargo, North Dakota, where they've had success with these. And without that kind of tool in the toolbox, it's going to be very difficult to have a developer come in, risk millions of dollars, you know, and not be sure or better or more comfortable with the investment that they're going to make here.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Mayor.
In relation to that, I have put together a committee to review any RFPs that we come in, and there's nine individuals in there, and besides the chair, it's a gender equal committee, and they are people that are very, very representative and professionals in the city of Fergus Falls, and they all made a very, very considered decision to sit down and work with this.
You know, just talk about the facility a little bit. It is all connected. It is very narrow. It was designed that way to treat people who were at that time considered mentally ill. It has a full-size gymnasium that many schools in our area would love to have on their campus. It has a full-size kitchen. They were making three meals a day for up to how many people?
2,500.
2,500 people when they were going full speed back in the 60s and 70s. So it's quite a campus, and some of that is still usable. A developer could come in there and with a minimal effort put some of that back into production.
Mr. Chair and members, I do want to make this clear. The heat on this facility, according to the state of Minnesota, is set to be shut off sometime in May. The last remaining program, of which the city of Fergus Falls and the county are building a facility for them, is they're expected to leave this facility sometime in 2007. So at that point in time, the state of Minnesota has told us that they will shut off the heat on this facility, and in fact, they're letting some contracts out for demolishment of some of the buildings in the background already. So we're kind of, we feel a sense of urgency to act on getting some tools in the toolbox, or more of the demolishment will start to occur as the state indicates that, you know, they want to move forward with this asset.
Thank you, members. I think we need Senator Scoy, something important?
Well, it isn't real important other than I was going to comment and maybe get later on from Mr. Stanislawski as I look at the revenue note here. You know, it's $10,000 in 2010 and $40,000 in 2011. We would know that with the scope of the proposal that the revenue would, you know, climb from that, and if you had any forecasts of what that might be in 12, 13, 15 kind of stuff, we would want to have that at some point.
Well, Mr. Chairman, members, I think we probably need to move on. We've got kind of a long agenda. Senator Scogin and members of the Fergus Falls community, thank you for bringing this to our attention. It really would be a marvelous plan if we could figure out a way to preserve the building and give it an alternative use. So we'll spend some time thinking about what we might be able to do to buy some time at least before it's too late. So without objection, Chair lays over Senate file 1634 for possible inclusion. Senator Scogin, thank you.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much.
Senator Quoak here. Whatever you would like, Senator.
Mr. Chair.
Welcome to the Tax Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is my first time in front of this illustrious committee. thank you very much. And Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the first bill up will have a Senate file 1400. We hear a lot down here about wastewater treatment facilities, and some of them that are desperately needed have trouble getting permits. And I have some in my district. And then there are others that are very much needed, and the communities are having difficulty finding funding. And I have a couple of those in my districts. This story is a little different. This wastewater treatment facility in Buffalo, set for expansion, has already had the permitting. And the city has made provisions for the $14.65 million needed for the funding. And what they are asking for from us today is a sales tax exemption. Of the $7 million in materials and supplies estimated, $700,000 is what they're asking for the exemption. Already, because the wastewater treatment plant's current law provides for exemptions for supplies for much of what's needed for this wastewater treatment plant. So we're looking for an exemption on the remaining $700,000. And there is a fund impact on this. You'll see with 90% of the funding in 2008, and then in 6 months of 2009, there'd be an additional $5,000. And then with me today is the city administrator, Merton Auger, and I'll let him describe the project a little, tell you why it's needed, and then we can answer any questions.
First of all, my name is Merton Auger. I'm city administrator for the city of Buffalo. Thank you for consideration of this bill. The Crow River, in which we discharge to, is known as an impaired water, and the MPCA has said there cannot be any more phosphorus put into the river because it is in such condition. The city of Buffalo went beyond what the permit requirements were and is attempting through this project to get down to as near zero phosphorus discharge as it can. The PCA always looks at point source pollution as being a source of reduction because non-point sources are hard to control and hard to reduce. There is no other federal or state money into this project. It is all entirely local, and it does make an impact to the local citizens, even though it may be a small-looking amount to you. It is a major amount to the citizens of Buffalo, and we would like to request that you look kindly on this request.
Mr. Auger, $14.6 million project. Does $45,000 of sales tax make any difference?
We look at everything we do as making a difference. We try to save where we can for the citizens, and yes, $45,000 does make a difference to them. When you add it all up, Senator.
Mr. Auger, I asked that question because my background is in the construction industry, and I understand change orders and how numbers on projects can fluctuate. And in a project this size, it's a pretty small change order that can cause $45,000 worth of changes in your construction costs. So I was just curious why it's that important. It doesn't seem like a lot of money in a project that big, but...
Mr. Chair.
Senator Langseth?
Mr. Chair, of course, every year we have many of these different projects. Have we ever exempted sales tax, these projects for sales tax, the wastewater treatment?
Mr. Chair, wastewater treatment facilities the supplies for those are already exempt. But as to an additional sales tax for the additional materials, there is a Chatfield wastewater treatment facility exemption from a few years ago, but other than that, no.
Senator Ortman.
Mr. Chair, Senator Koch, good bill. I think all the local governments are having a difficult time with the construction costs for their expansions and their wastewaters and their courthouses. We were denied our tax exemption from Carver County for the construction materials for our courthouse because we frankly don't do that on a statewide basis because it's just too much money. But our wastewater treatment system, it sounds like there might be a little niche where you might be able to fit this bill in, and I'm hoping the members of this committee will find that to be a very attractive proposal because we want clean water. And I'm hopeful that this committee will start putting its money where its mouth is and say these local governments need some help offsetting the costs of these major construction projects, and I hope this committee will support this one.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Ortman, thank you for your comments. I would also like to point out, as Mr. Auger had stated, this project, we're trying to go above and beyond even the permitting requirements. We're really trying to do our part to get zero emissions from Buffalo, and it's a growing community, so we put our share of phosphorus in. We're just trying to clean that out. So that's 45. And also, Mr. Chair, you can be assured that if we'll come all this way for $45,000, the city administrator is going to be watching those change orders too.
Thank you, Senator Goldbub. Point well taken, Mr. Administrator.
Yes,
watch the change orders.
Can't stand change orders.
Without objection, Chair lays over Senate File 1400 for possible inclusion.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Auger, for coming down. Senator Koch, you have one more bill in front of us today. Why don't we take that as long as you're
thank
at the
you,
table.
Mr. Chair. Next, I'll call up, it's Mayor Michael Beyer from the City of Rockford, and this is Senate File 1562. This bill is also fairly straightforward. The City of Rockford is looking for a local sales tax option. They need to do some improvements on their flood control system levy and also some Crow River. You're hearing a lot about the Crow River, but we have some Crow River Bank erosion issues in Rockford, and this is the costs are about $1 million for the levee system and then about $700,000 for the erosion. And the council came forward with a resolution asking for the local sales tax, and so that's what we're here for today. It's local sales tax option with it would require, of course, local approval through the voters. And I can let the mayor speak to you a little bit about that project, why he feels it's important, and what he's prepared to do with the.
Thank you and good morning. My name is Michael Beyer, the mayor of Rockford. And after the 1965 flood, Rockford was devastated, like everybody else in southern Minnesota. That levee then was dump truck loads of dirt just to put on to save the city of Rockford in 68 and 69. Now, almost 40 years later, we do not have a 1-3 slope, 1-4 slope. It's pretty much a 1-1 slope. 98 took a big chunk out of it. If a few trees fall down, I won't have a levee, and I'll be back to 1965. What I'm hoping to do in doing our research is at a half percent sales tax, the state has indicated how much that would be, that would cover then the bond payment for approximately a 20 to 25 year period to pay for that $1.7 million. The option of taking it to the city and imposing a levy to do that would be rather devastating for our small city of 3,700. But the loss of downtown, which has been estimated at $4.5 million in business, $1.7 million fix is, a reasonable request. If you have any questions, I'll be
Senator
more
Johnson.
Than happy.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I'm sorry, I didn't catch your name.
Beyer.
You answered my question. You're asking for a half-cent sales tax local option?
Half
a percent. And your testimony just made me realize or reminded me that cities that have rivers running through them have to maintain those. And I hope that your voters approve your referendum. Thank you.
Senator Langseth, do you have any provisions in law to give cities like Rockford an opportunity to access some state bonding for these flood control projects?
Well, we have state bonds that every every large bonding bill. I think it was $25 million last time, $27 million time before, but usually they request it through the DNR, and the DNR comes with a pretty long list.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for that question, because we are going to be pursuing all our options for this. I'm not much of a sandbagger, and so we're looking at all options. And actually, the city of Delano, which is just downriver from the city of Rockford, received some flood mitigation funding through the bonding last year. And, you know, we're looking at all our options.
Senator Polk, I think it would be wise to get in line. Next year's a bonding year, and it's very likely the state will appropriate some additional money for flood control mitigation projects. So I think that would be wise to get an application in for that. Because there are resources available.
Thank you.
Any other question, members?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Larson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Beyer. I think it was yesterday that we were in state and local government talking about the fact that Hennepin County and is it Wright County are both in the city limits of Rockford. And so does that mean that the sales tax, you have a different sales tax depending on what part of town you're in? Is that correct, based on last year's Twins legislation? And do you have any parcels that collect that in that side of Rockford?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Senator Larson, you're correct. I do have conflicting sales tax going on, which has caused downtown Rockford to be busier than the Hennepin County part of Rockford, i.e. the local tavern. It's easy to walk across the bridge and pay less. Thank Plus you can smoke there, too. So.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We have an amendment to this one. Anything else, members? Senator Polk, anything further?
No, thank you very much, committee and Mr. Chair, for hearing these worthy projects.
Without objection, Chair lays over Senate File 1562 for possible inclusion. Members, we still have several bills. I think, Senator Rummel, if we could, we have some bills up where we have people from out of town here. And we just want to make sure we get to them. Is Senator Stump here? I believe we've had people from Crookston travel down. Can maybe somebody in the staff can find Senator Stump. Maybe while Senator Stump is coming down, Commissioner Fenwick from Grand Marais. Senator Rummel, we just want to make sure we get to the people from out of town that came a long distance. Probably about 20 minutes. Okay. What room are you in?
112, that's where Senator Stump is.
Okay. Very good. Send him over, please. Members, Senate File 1771 is a bill that I have authored on behalf of Cook County in my district. And just to remind you where Cook County is, that is the very tip of the state that sticks out into Lake Superior. Commissioner Fenwick, welcome to the Tax Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senators. I appreciate the opportunity to address you today. I will try to be as brief as possible what is in front of you as far as the bill is concerned, and hopefully an amendment that will be attached is very straightforward as to what Cook County is requesting. I very briefly want to paint a little bit of an economic picture and perhaps even a social picture of Cook County as to why this is being requested. I won't be long-winded, but I want to speak to what is relevant in relation to asking for the sales tax. A couple of things I'd like to point out. This is from a study that was done back in 2003 by the University of Minnesota Extension to show where Cook County is really headed. I have figures here showing that gross sales in the city of Grand Marais in 1996 were about $52 million. In 2003, those gross sales in the city of Grand Marais in adjusted dollars was down to below $20 million, a decrease of 54%. In Cook County, in that same year, 1996, total sales were $81.5 million. And in 2003, they had grown to $101 million, or a growth of 51%. In both of these instances, in a number that is called the pull factor, which I would describe as what percentage of the people in your community are you selling to, in both of those instances, that pull factor is still below 100%. In other words, we are selling to less than 100% of the people who live in our community. The pull factor for tourism, specifically for hotels, in the year 2000 was 15.35. So you can see how much of an effect that tourism right now has on Cook County and Grand Marais in particular. A last item of a note I would like to point out in what is called a summary of Cook County retail trade, where they took 14 areas of merchandising. Of the 14, if you were to put a number on what would be the expected sales, in seven of those areas, Cook County was below what they would have expected in that year. In seven of those areas, they were above. But in the area of hotels, they were 1,772% above what they would have expected in 2003. The economy has changed. In a separate study that was done by a group of local citizens, I wish to point this out, a very well-meaning group and I think a pretty thorough study. A couple of items I'd like to point out from there. In 1920, the picture of Cook County was something like this in terms of employment. Something less than 5% of the people in the Cook County were employed in tourism. Something more than 65% were included in what I would call local resource industry, fishing, timber, et cetera. In 1970, those numbers were essentially equal. In 2010, those numbers are to look like this. Approximately 60% of the employment in Cook County will be tourism. Approximately 5% will be what I would call local resource industry. Today, 80% of the economy is fully in Cook County tourism. 65% of the spending in Cook County is fully spent by people who are directly involved in the tourism industry. I paint that very relevant picture for you to indicate that we are not unlike what many of the western counties are today, counties where the timber industry has been greatly reduced, jobs have been greatly reduced, and in fact, in many of those counties, sales taxes have been used as a fund to fund the general fund in those counties and been appropriated by the state to do that. So when the needs that are before you come up in Cook County in the sizable dollars that they do, and when we look at the people that we are serving, a great percentage of those people being either in and out or very seasonably in terms of staying in our area, we look for funding that is something other than what would be putting it on the back of the local 5,000 residences in terms of sales tax. And we think it's appropriate as we compare ourselves to some of those western counties. Now to the specifics of the what is before you. Briefly, the library has been involved in a study up there. The people involved were Ron McGriff, a 20-year veteran of being a consultant librarian, and SJA Architects. Some of the relevant factors. The service area for the Grand Marais Library is fully all of Cook County. Many of the cardholders are from well outside the Grand Marais area. Many of the cardholders, probably double of what the normal percentage you would expect to be, are actually reciprocal cardholders from the Twin Cities area. It falls in the area of about 14% of those people. In the summer, many, many more people use the library in Cook County than would in other times of the year, pointing specifically to the problem that is not akin just to the library but to many of the facilities in Cook County. They need to be built for a population that far exceeds what our 5,000 plus population is in the county. The study arrived at the fact that there was a need for probably an additional 10,000 square feet added to the library, amenities, including shelves, of course, internet, and so forth. The initial number that came up last year in terms of needs as far as dollars is approximately $2 million. Grand Marais has now a pool which is dilapidated, needs to be replaced or repaired. They have done a study. Fully one-third of the people who use the pool come from Grand Marais, a third come from the rest of the county, and a third come from people who are transient in the community. The study showed that the cost of repair of that facility was at least equal to the cost of rebuilding a facility. And numbers that are given to, I think you have in front of you an architect's drawing of a potential pool, would be approximately $6 million. The third area of concern is a recreation area that we are proposing in the area of the school in Grand Marais. There is quite a large area where there is joint ownership of land, Grand Marais City, Cook County, and the school. I think the significant thing about this project is that we have joined into a joint powers agreement, that being city, school, and county, to form a board that would be organized to carry on the needs for that particular area in terms of operation and maintenance of that recreation area, and to look after other full county recreation needs that are there. The tribe is also involved in this in a position of advisory. They can't be involved in terms of on the board itself, but they are very involved in and will be looking to help us with decisions being made. And finally, and of immediate importance, because of the discussions we are having with trying to free up dollars for the tourism community to market their facilities, you may know that $200,000 per year plus of marketing dollars out of the west end of Cook County are being used to fund bonds for the Superior National Golf Course. And we are looking toward freeing those monies up and taking that burden off of the western part tourism area, and to fund that $200,000 a year for the next approximately 4 years with the sales tax. We think it is the best use of that money for the entire area of Cook County. That, in a nutshell, is where we're at on where we're looking at for Cook County. I'd be happy to address any questions that you may have.
Commissioner Fenwick and members, Cook County has had a 1% sales tax for quite a long time. Commissioner, maybe you can speak to the 1% sales tax that Cook County has had in place, currently has in place, and I think kind of to the success of it in the hospital and nursing home area.
The success has been dramatic. I think if we would go back, we're not unlike any other place where the citizens would have looked at adding that 1% sales tax and wondering if it would have a negative impact on the community. A, it has not done that. B, it turned out to be an excellent source of funding for the hospital. The people in the community have been very much behind it. It was 1%. It was designed to fund initially the cost of the expansion of the Cook County Hospital. Once again, I would note that the hospital is very much like the library. It needs to serve a population quite in excess of our normal 5,000 people. It was used additionally to fund an expansion of the care center in Cook County. Both were very successful. Both are good businesses in Cook County. I would throw in just a little tweak to the committee that as we are compared to all other facilities in the state, our care center is in the midst of losing $1 million per year. A hospital continues to support that, but the community continues to support the hospital. The tax has worked very well in that regard.
Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A couple of questions for Mr. Fenwick. Is there a referendum involved?
Yes, there would be. We have asked for a referendum in November.
And Mr. Fenwick, Mr. Chairman, I'm looking at this handout, and I've heard you refer to studies and architects, but have you put any of these projects out to bid and got a hard number on any of this?
No, we have not. That will be the effort of that Joint Powers Committee that we are referring to. The numbers that we have so far would be only estimates. And I would point out that one of the things that has prevented us from going forward really hard on this is really the reluctance on the part of both the city and the county, because of knowing full well that without some funding outside of our property tax, we may not have the ability to go forward. If we are able to go forward with some outside funding, we will be very quick to act on these issues.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Johnson.
Mr. Chairman, in no disrespect, Mr. Fenwick,
yes.
But I think the proposal is a little sketchy still. This we're looking at a drawing that I could do. I think if you're talking to an architect, I think some more clear-cut ideas, drawings, and numbers might be more helpful. So,
Senator, I appreciate that. This is a full book of what has been done in that study. It still does not generate the exact numbers that we need, and I would venture to say it still will be a brief work in progress. And one of the things that has happened is that as the city did their study on the swimming pool, very late in the process, they came and talked to the people at the county wondering whether or not the pool, which is now presently located at the tourist park down by the lake, should indeed be included in this area up by the school. And that will slow our process a bit, but it is something that we know that we must consider if we're going to look at this in the right way.
Anything else, members? Commissioner, maybe if you could share that packet with Senator Johnson or other members of the committee before you leave town, they get a little better look at the detail of what some of the facility looks like. Senator Senja?
Mr. Chair, and to the witness, I'm not finding anywhere in the bill where it identifies this is a half-cent tax or a one-cent tax or 10-cent tax, or is this only on line 2.16 it talks about impose a sales tax, but
Mr. Chair, Senator Sinjum, it's already exist in laws, although it's not stated here because
okay.
we're not amending the rate at all. There's already a one-cent rate in place,
okay.
and that is not being changed at okay. all by this legislation.
Members, I mean, we could all make an argument whether this is a regional project or not, but I think what I would argue that in a county with 5,000 people, who has, I think we all know the amount of tourism activity that happens on the North Shore, and when people like Senator Wieger, who owns a cabin up there, and Senator Hahn and Senator Boniff, who also own cabins up there, when they vacation up there, go up to their cabins, they expect a certain amount of recreational amenities to be in place. And they're the kind of amenities that those cabin owners full well, I think, understand that a county of 5,000 people can't provide for on their own. And I think where this is a little different is this is a countywide tax rather than a city tax, much like when we did a countywide tax for Hennepin County. I do think the regional nature probably changes some when a local sales tax is imposed countywide. And every citizen in the county is going to be given an opportunity to vote on this. And if people in the county don't support it, it's not going to happen. Senator Pogomar.
Mr. Chairman, I was curious why Senator Boniff was a co-author. Would Senator Boniff and her family and Senator Wieger and his family have an opportunity to vote on this also?
Senator Pogomiller, if Senator Wieger can establish residency there before the vote takes place, and he tells me he's got his home for sale down here, and he's seriously considering a move to Grand Marais.
Senator Pogomiller, we would welcome any new residents to Cook County.
And if they have, and if they're young enough that they have kids that we can put in the school to help with our state aid to the school district, that would help.
And Senator Pogomiller, if I understand the efforts on the election committees for how people would be registered to vote, it could happen very quickly, I would imagine.
Based on today's article,
yes.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Limmer.
I know your area is well known for the tourism industry. It's got a lot of natural resources that people like to go there for. How big of an industry is that, people-wise? How many people travel through this area in order, if this passed, to deposit a few extra shekels in the pot to pay for these things? What kind of numbers are we looking at?
Well, I think we'll have Commissioner Fenwick try to address that, but I believe last time I looked at the tax capacity of Cook County, over 60% of their tax capacity was seasonal rec. It's people like Senator Boniff and Senator Hahn and Senator Wieger that are part-time residents of the region that I think there's a question whether you call them tourists or not. We often have that discussion up around Lake Vermilion. There's all those snowbirds that come and spend a few months or a few weeks. Are they really tourists, or are they more of a summer resident? So I think it's a little hard to quantify how much will be paid by actual tourists passing through and what percentage will be paid by summer or residents who have cabins there. So it's probably kind of hard to get your arms around. It's a little different than other local sales taxes, because there are so many summer residents in the Grand Marais area. But, Commissioner, if you have some information on that.
No, I think your assessment is correct, and we would try to differentiate those between tourism and seasonal residences. But fully in the study that was done by the economic group in Cook County this year, 60-some percent of the spending is by those entities that cater to tourism. 82% of the total economy, if you say, do you spend your money in the grocery store as a seasonal person or a tourist? Do you spend your money at the hotel? Do you spend your money at the gas station as a seasonal resident or a tourist? That's approximately 82% of our total economy comes from those seasonal people or tourists.
Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Mr. Fenwick, Senator Dibble and I just went through the entire book, and it's very ambitious. What you have everything but the kitchen sink in your proposal. And not to be facetious, I don't mean any disrespect, Mr. Chairman, but either you know how to stretch a dollar for a very long way, or your local option sales tax is going to last 120 years.
Well, Senator Johnson, the bill says they can issue bonds not to exceed $14 million. That doesn't, so there is a cap on what can be done here, and some of the projects you see might not be done, but there is a cap on what their bonding authority is.
And Senator Johnson, I'd appreciate that. Yes, I think perhaps our eyes might be bigger than our stomachs. But I think that it is only right for the county to look in terms of what it is potentially it can do. We are really underserved right now in terms of those facilities. And frankly, even five, 10 years ago, we were wondering, how do we get people to, as Senator Pogemer was alluding to, move to our area? I mean, we really do need those permanent residences. And in order to do that, I think we are convinced that some of these services need to be provided. Some may be really, truly pie in the sky, but that is what that Joint Powers Group has been put together to do, and that's to analyze what it is we'd really like to do and sit down and put down on paper and really fund from year to year what it is we're able to do.
Senator Langseth moves the A1 amendment. And members, what this does, currently they have a 3% lodging tax like other areas in the state do, and 2% of that, I believe, Commissioner, is being spent to pay for the bonds on the golf course. So Cook County is one of the exceptions to the lodging tax in that the 2/3 of it is actually being used to retire golf course bonds. And we all know how protective the tourism community is over lodging taxes, but they've been very creative over the years to try find a way to build some of these amenities that the public and the people that vacation there expect. So what this amendment would do is it would allow that debt service on those bonds for the golf course to go with the local sales tax, and then the lodging tax money would be freed up for the use that we expect lodging tax money to be used for, to try and market the area. On the A1 amendment, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Contrary, no. Motion prevails. The A1 amendment is adopted. Anything else, members, on Senate File 1771?
Mr. Chair, we appreciate all that you're doing for southern Minnesota people that travel to your area. So, keep up the good work.
You know, Senator Senjum, I hear from people every week around this Capitol, members or staff or lobbyists that work here, that they say, I was in your district last week, and most times it's the North Shore they refer to. And when they don't refer to the North Shore, they're referring to Ely.
That's right.
Senator Pogemer.
Mr. Chairman, I appreciate the bill because it's laying foundation for Senate File 6, which will be here soon. The dance area that you're providing in your facility, I think, shows how deeply embedded the arts are in culture throughout the state.
Senator Pogemiller, the arts, there is a very, very active arts colony in Grand Marais. And we're very proud of that, and I'm very defensive of that. Matter of fact, when we built a new school, there's an arts component in the new high school at Grand Marais.
Senator Bach does not speak out of turn. It is called an art colony in Grand Marais.
So, Mr. Chairman, a suggestion for the ribbon cutting. I think Senator Bonoff, Han, and Uyghur should participate in curling and skateboard activities.
After Mr. Chair, after they get done with the equestrian activities.
Was that here too?
Yeah. Did you see the skateboard park? Did you mention that?
No.
And the old
folks.
No, Senator.
Mr. Chair, anytime you would like to gavel us into order, I would agree. Please, Mr. Chair.
Without objection, Chair lays over Senate File 1771 as amended for possible inclusion. Thank you, Commissioner.
Thank you, Senator. Thank you, Senators.
Mr. Chairman, just an observation. It seems like more than possible that one.
We'll see if we have room. We're trying to keep the tax bill under 600 pages, Senator Pogemiller.
Doesn't anyone do shuffleboard anymore?
I better contact my House member and see how it's coming on the House. Senator Stumpf, welcome to the Tax Committee. Senate File 1611.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. It's interesting to sit back there and listen to your conversation.
You're next.
We have, I have with me the City Administrator of Crookston, Aaron Parrish. And then our proposal is for a half-cent sales tax, but it's more along the lines of what the city of Crookston is trying to do to protect itself from the flooding. As you know, back in 97, Crookston got flooded as well, and there's a fairly large flood project that's going on currently and doing the trying to protect different parts of the city. Well, one of the areas where the new dike is going to go is right where the current arena, the current ice arena is, and so that has to be replaced. And so the city of Crookston is looking at a way to pay for their portion or their part. Well, basically, a way to pay for it. The replacement of it, and so the sales tax of a half a cent would be put on the ballot this fall if approved by this committee and by the legislature, and it would operate for I believe up to, what is it, 10 years, 25 years. So, Mr. Chairman, if I could maybe defer to Mr. Parrish.
Mr. Parrish, welcome to the Tax Committee.
Thank you very much, Chairman.
There's also a handout that I think is helpful.
Chair, members of this committee, for the record, my name is Aaron Parrish. I'm the Crookston City Administrator. Certainly appreciate the opportunity to be here today and extend a warm thanks from our mayor and residents of the committee, as well as our city council. It's through a set of unique circumstances that we have the opportunity to bring this bill forward for your consideration. As you may or may not be aware, we do have a significant flood control project occurring in the community. And as the handout you're about to receive illustrates, we are building a dike right through the middle of our arena facility. This will protect a neighborhood of approximately 160 homes from ongoing and future flooding. If you see on the second page, this is something that we have to deal with more often than we care to admit. Last year, we had a significant flood event. This has occurred approximately three or four times over the last 10 to 15 years. We literally live on the edge every spring, and certainly as we go on in the future, the problem is only being exacerbated. So at the core of this request is allowing us to facilitate our flood control project. We have been very thankful and grateful to DNR Waters for their assistance in the Flood Hazard Mitigation Grant Program, and have really appreciated their work. And the legislature absolutely have appreciated the support that has been provided. And we are on a track to complete our project over a few successive bonding sessions. Just to go a little bit into more detail, I don't want to take up too much of your time. I certainly understand you have a lot going on today. The tax would be for a maximum amount of $10 million. That would include both principal and interest on some debt. The existing arena replacement is estimated at $10 million. So the local option sales tax is not the only component of the financing plan. We also will be investing local resources as well as seeking resources through the flood hazard mitigation plan program as well. I guess just to address the regional nature of this facility, certainly that's something the committee takes into strong consideration as these requests go forward. And I think we have a few to offer. First and foremost, this facility serves the University of Minnesota Crookston's men's hockey program, as well as some of their other recreational needs. So we do have them as a tenant in our building. They bring in teams from throughout the upper Midwest, even had some folks from New Hampshire in this last season. So we served that program. And as a transplant to Greater Minnesota approximately 3 years ago, my family and I made that move. Didn't really have an appreciation for what hockey means to communities in northwest and northern Minnesota. And it's amazing the amount of tourism activity that is generated from the broader region and from our part of the world, Canada. We have hockey tournaments. We will get 8 to 10 teams from Canada coming down, spending money in the local community, and our local merchants certainly tell us when we have those activities, which is, you know, virtually every weekend, it makes a difference for our community. And so I guess with that, be happy to answer any questions that you might have with regard to our request.
Mr. Parrish, again for me, the cost of the Regional Recreational Center is how much of the $10 million?
The $10 million only includes the arena replacement. The Regional Recreation Center component has not yet been identified. We are looking at two options for that, and then that would result in some additional expenditures. One option would involve adding on to the proposed arena facility. The other option would involve working with the University of Minnesota Crookston as they look to evaluate a wellness center on their campus. If that concept proceeds, it would be a public-private or a university-community partnership that we would provide our residents. So those are the two options, but they're still in the process of being defined.
So, Mr. Parrish, if the committee was to take out the flood control component of this and allow the rest of the bill to go, how much less than $10 million would you need?
Chair, members of the committee, the flood control or the arena replacement is integral. I mean, that is the core priority to what it is we're talking about. The Regional Recreation Center piece, you know, probably if we look at this, would be about $1 million at most. I mean, we're not looking at a substantial component there. So I guess we are looking at hoping to retain the $10 million for a couple of reasons. One, it's uncertain how our other funding package will proceed. This is sort of the first component, the legislative component in terms of what flood hazard mitigation grant programming or funding could be available is uncertain. And so we want to have maximum flexibility, and I guess we feel the legislation as currently proposed provides that.
Mr. Parrish, I'm just trying to help.
Thank you, sir.
Senator DeVille.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just looking at the map here. I see there's a bunch of housing units that the levy would also go through. What's to come of or what has happened to those housing units?
Chair, Senator, members of the committee, those houses would be acquired under the Flood Hazard Mitigation Grant Program in order to provide dike protection for the remainder of the neighborhood.
Thanks.
Anything else, members? Senator Dibble.
I had a different question. I recall that up in Crookston there was the opposite problem with the Red River. The drought period caused some erosion of the bank and some mm-hmm. threat to some buildings. Whatever came of that problem?
Chair, Senator, members of the committee, we have resolved that problem. We have completed the acquisitions for our landslide area. Mm-hmm. The remaining component is the fix. How do we stabilize the bank? Mm-hmm. And we are currently in the engineering stage of designing that.
And, Mr. Chair, how much is that all costing?
Based on the current funding available, we're looking at approximately $1 million project there.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Langseth.
Mr. Chair, when my Capital Investment Committee was up in northwestern Minnesota, Senator Gerlach was with us. We went from town to town and hurt the people. Senator Gerlach says, does every town in this area flood? And I guess it's pretty close to that. But, you know, East Grand Forks was one that cost the most, and we got 65% money there, and we're wrapping that up now. That was a big cost. But now Crookston is coming on, and DNR has advised us not to wait for federal money because it's diminishing. In fact, we can't seem to wrap up Breckenridge simply because we're waiting for the federal money. So we're going mainly with state money in Crookston, and you're talking about a lot of money, probably as high as $30 million. So we provided quite a bit last time, and the next two bonding bills. Hopefully we can have enough so that we can probably wrap it up. But the main reason I'm here this term is to try to get those communities to the point where they're protected by the time I either leave or die, one of the two.
Whichever comes first. Yeah.
So, Mr. Parrish, let me understand. If we gave the authorization to use the local sales tax to replace the arena and do the regional community center, does that get you where you would like to be? And we let Senator Langseth do the rest?
Chair, members of the committee, absolutely. We feel this legislation gets us to where we need to be and utilizes the local option sales tax to the maximum extent that we feel to be reasonable in the community.
Anything else, members? Thank you, Mr. Parrish. Senator Stump, chair lays over without objection. Senate Bill 1611 for possible inclusion. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members.
Senator Rummel. Senate File 1409 is in front of the committee. Senator Rummel, welcome to the Tax Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. I understand you put in long hours last night, so I'll be brief. I have a relatively simple bill to bring before you today. It extends the tax exemption for re-refined motor oil and certain recycled papers. The whole point of the bill is to provide incentives to not only government but to private agencies to purchase and to use recycled paper and re-refined motor oil. In my former life, I was a communications consultant, and I frequently ran up against estimating the cost of paper for printing all kinds of documents. And recycled paper, especially in the beginning years, was somewhat more expensive than regular paper. And so my clients were constantly balking against the what I thought was the right thing to do in saving our forests because of the cost. So this tax incentive makes it somewhat more attractive for people to, especially copier papers and a number of other papers that we use just tons of. It gives them the incentive to purchase those papers. And I think at the same time, it begins to create a larger market. We already have the capacity to produce the papers. What we need to do is make sure that people are buying them. I can give you a couple of little factoids here. Currently, 25% of Minnesota's garbage is recyclable paper. That's 751 tons of paper. So there's a real value in just getting that paper out of the landfills to using it again and saving a few trees at the same time. Another factoid is that using re-refined motor oil could save us enough oil to run 35 million cars smoothly for a year. It would reduce our dependence on foreign oil and reduce our trade deficit by $150 million. There's a small cost to this. Now, my numbers are a little bit old, but I believe in I don't have the exact
Senator, date. Senator Rummel, we have a fiscal note that revenue supplied to us that indicate that the cost of this bill is $130,000 in FY08, $150,000 in FY09.
Thank you. They did not give me a copy of that. I'm sorry. Thank you. Appreciate it. So for that small cost, I think we have some major benefits to consider. With that, I'll stand for what few questions I think I can answer.
Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I see, Senator Rummel, that you have a sunset on both of these, July 1st, 2009. You think
yes.
That's enough time to spark the market?
That's the group that brought this bill to me. That's their belief. If we can change the habits of the buying habits of people, The paper looks as good. The re-refined oil works as well. If we can change the buying habits, we think we will have shifted the thinking a little bit. So, yes, 2 years is the sunset.
Thank you.
Senator Scoy.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. And Senator Rummel, I see that this is only for gasoline engines, and I'm wondering about the rationale for that, because when I think about used oil, you know, a gasoline engine uses 5 or 6 quarts, and a lot of the diesel engines will use 10 or 12 gallons. And I also think about the nature of the oil changing that goes on. Diesel engines are generally done in a shop where it's a lot easier to, you know, there are companies doing it, and it's easier to collect, where a lot of the car oil changes are done by individuals. And I was just curious as to what the rationale was for not including diesel engines in your proposal.
I don't know the answer to that, but I'd certainly be open to changing it to include diesel.
Senator Marty.
Mr. Chair, Senator Scoy, is when you have a 10 or 12-gallon oil change, I'm not familiar with diesel engines that well. Would they be buying re-refined oil now? Because there would be a big change in behavior. A small price change would be noticed easily.
Mr. Chair and Senator Marty, I would believe not. But I don't know. But it certainly is, a lot more gallons per motor, and it's also more concentrated into one spot. I think most of these facilities would have, you know, big bulk barrels that they would be drawing out of, and as opposed to the individuals who are doing gasoline engines.
Mr. Chairman, in that case, I think it would have a big impact if you apply it to diesel engines as well. And
just was curious.
Offer an amendment. Offer an amendment.
I am not ready to offer an amendment, Senator Marty. Okay.
Senator Scoyer probably makes the fiscal note bigger.
I think it probably would.
Good idea, but yeah. Probably makes it cost more. Anything else, members? Is anybody else? Senator Dibble.
Mr. Chair, I just realized I don't know the distinction between used and re-refined oil.
And some of you may know more about this than I do, but when the oil is changed, it's re-refined so it can be used again. If it's simply used and discarded, it has to be re-refined. It has to be cleaned up so that it can be used again.
So
used oil is it's the step before re-refined oil.
Oh, okay. Thank you. So, Mr. Chair, so used oil would be sold to someone who would do the re-refining, and the refined oil will be sold to the end user.
Right.
Correct.
Thank you. And
used oil is not subject to sales tax now.
Right.
Okay. Senator Rummel.
I did get a note from the person who gave me this bill, and he said that there are two small American companies, one called Safety Clean and the other called Hicks Oils, that are very good at doing this. So these are local companies that would benefit from this market.
Anybody, Senator Marty.
Mr. Chairman, could we ask for a fiscal note on the diesel engine addition? Because I think we were discussing that. I think it would have a bigger impact on behavioral change because it's purchased in such quantities and so on that it might make a bigger difference. So if it would be possible to get a fiscal note on what adding diesel engines would be.
Can revenue tell us how much re-refined motor oil is used in diesel engines in the next week? Okay, good point, Senator Marie. Anyone in the audience want to testify for or against the bill? If not, without objection, Chair lays over Senate File 1409 for possible inclusion. Senator Rummel, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Schotter. Senator Chaudhry has Senate File 1476.
Thanks,
Senator
Mr. Chaudhry, Chair.
Welcome to the Tax Committee.
Thank you. This bill was in the tax bill last year. It has to do with New Brighton TIF district, and its intent to use the proceeds for environmental cleanup. By way of background, New Brighton had secured an agreement from Medtronic to build a major expansion in this northwest quadrant of 35W and 694. There were some cleanup issues. We thought that that they had been overcome. New Brighton, the city of New Brighton, had put up its own money to do this cleanup for the purposes of the Medtronic development. In the meantime, the Medtronic got a different offer that did not have some of these challenges, and so that was ended up being built in Moundsview, and the legislature passed a TIF provision for that. Instead of the Medtronic development, the city proceeded with a multi-use development for which it was still going to need cleanup. But because that multi-use development included residential, the PCA came in and said, well, you need to clean it up even more. And so because the upshot is because the Medtronic proposal left, PCA increased the amount of spending that was going to be needed for the environmental cleanup, and so New Brighton is now in desperate need of extra dollars to fund that fund the cleanup to residential standards, and that's the reason why we need this TIF plan. This passed the Senate and was in the final hour of the Tax Conference Committee last year. Ron Abrams simply would not agree to it, and so that's why it was not adopted last year.
Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If this is kind of a good idea for TIF, and I remember listening to it last year, but Anoka County and a few other counties are working on an environmental fund this year, and we have yet to resolve that over the next couple of weeks. So that would be another area. It would take time for Anoka County to build up the funds, but it's another area for you to get some future money if they're able to get that passed.
Senator Johnson, your references to the deed tax?
No. Actually, you're right. That is how it's funded, isn't it? The environmental funds.
Mm-hmm. There's the deed tax for housing. There's a deed tax for environmental fund. So hopefully those will pass. FYI, this is in Ramsey County. But I think Ramsey County is working on the same thing, too.
Yes, that's correct.
Well, Ramsey County does have money available for the deed tax for environmental cleanup now.
My guess is that they've exhausted that idea to the extent that they could have. But let me introduce the city to chat about it a little bit more.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Grant Fernelius, the Community Development Director. The question about Ramsey County and their environmental fund, the city has received assistance through the county in the form of a loan to help with this project. So I believe Ramsey County has made efforts through that deed tax program to provide funding, and the city of New Brighton has received some assistance.
Thank you. Anything else, members?
Well, Mr. Chair.
Senator Skoy.
I'm sorry, Senator Chaudhry, if I didn't catch this or if you already covered this. Why do we need to have activities outside the TIF district again? I didn't catch that part of it.
Go ahead and talk about that.
Mr. Chair, Senator, the legislation refers to an existing tax increment district number 26, which is about 2 miles south of the Northwest Quadrant project. That district is expected to have surplus tax increment revenues of about $2.5 million. The legislation would allow the city to tap into those resources to help pay for cleanup within the Northwest Quadrant. So they're two separate projects, two separate tax increment districts.
Mr. Chair, so they're two separate tax increment districts, but you're going to use surplus in one of them to do work in the other?
Mr. Chair, Senator, that is correct.
It's kind of a pooling arrangement then, Mr. Chair.
Right.
Thank you for that clarification.
Anything else, committee? Senator Johnson.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Chaudhry, Okay, is this anywhere near the old arsenal?
Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, are you talking about the TCAP arsenal? It's somewhat near. They're not really connected. If you take a look at the map, it's the arsenal is to the northeast, but it's still about a mile or two away.
Mr. Chair and Senator Chaudhary, I guess I wasn't paying attention. What contaminated the ground?
Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, in this case, it was a company called Midwest Asphalt. So the ground is contamination is related to that company, not the arsenal.
Senator Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Senator Chaudhary, what is their liability to this issue?
Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, just to be clear on it, the contamination actually, preceded Midwest Asphalt, which is the property that the city acquired.
Okay.
It dates back about 30 to 40 years ago. There was an oil refinery on that site, which was then sold to Midwest Asphalt. They operated an asphalt plant on that property for a number of years. The city acquired it about a year ago. We have done extensive testing, and we were aware of the contamination on that site. It's our understanding that the state, the MPCA, has chosen not to go after the responsible party. So the city was really in the position, if it wanted to proceed with the development, that it would have to take responsibility for the cleanup. The issue which has become, I think, most pressing is that in addition to the contamination, which we've known about, is the fact that we ran into very poor soils. There's peat, there's organic soils that you can't build on. And that is what has increased the cost of this project and has necessitated the city's request for this legislation. So the costs have gone up really beyond what we had originally anticipated. And again, beyond what we had previously discovered, simply because we didn't have full access to the site.
So, Mr. Fernelius, is it more about a soils correction than an environmental cleanup?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that is correct. It's a combination. The way that it's been described to us by our experts is that it's really a layer cake. There's clean soil, there's contaminated soil, there's poor soils, all of which have to be cleaned up or remediated in various ways, and the cost of this has simply gone up beyond our ability to pay for it.
Anything else, members? Thank you, Mr. Fernelius.
Thank
Senator Chaudhary.
For your time.
Without objection, Chair lays over Senate File 1476 for possible inclusion.
Thanks for your time.
Members, Thursday morning, 8:30. This meeting's adjourned.